Fast food workers in cities across the United States rallied for higher wages during a day of demonstrations yesterday. These protests were part of an ongoing campaign backed by union organizers to push for $15 an hour pay. NPR's Allison Aubrey has more.
In Chicago, police handcuffed and arrested demonstrators who blocked traffic at a busy intersection that has a McDonald's on one side of the street and a Burger King on the other.
We just took over the whole street. It was amazing. It was empowering. It was wonderful.
That's 26-year-old Jessica Davis, a McDonald's employee, who we reached on his cell phone.
We should not be.
Guys, please go on the sidewalk. Thank you.
She says she felt people really took notice. And what she wants them to know is this. McDonald's pays her about $9 an hour, which she says is not enough for a single mom raising two kids.
Yes, it's extremely hard. I'm forced to use government assistance to take care of my children.
She relies on food stamps, for instance, to buy her groceries. Labor economist Jack Temple works with the National Employment Law Project, which supports the drive for higher pay. He says Davis's story is common. Despite the idea that flipping burgers is a job for teenagers, he says the majority of fast food workers today are adults, and a third of them are parents supporting kids. He argues the industry can afford to pay more.
We know that this is a multi-billion dollar industry. McDonald's profits alone were $5.6 billion last year. There's plenty of revenue in this industry to afford a living wage.
In a statement, McDonald's says any increase in minimum wage should be implemented over time, so the impact is manageable. But jumping to $15 an hour, which is double the current minimum wage, Scott DeFife of the National Restaurant Association says that would be damaging. Restaurants would need to charge higher prices.
A $15 entry-level wage would definitely increase the cost of food, probably in the order of 35 to 40%.
Prices, he says, many fast food customers would not be willing to pay. But union organizers counter fast food workers must have a living wage. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
For decades, we were told that fat was bad, especially butter. Americans have recently renewed their love of butter, but just as we've begun to slather it on, comes word that there might be a shortage. NPR's Allison Aubrey investigates whether we ought to be alarmed.
There's a growing number of Americans who seem to believe that everything is better with butter. Ashley Armstrong says she's definitely in this camp.
Yes, I love butter. Everything's better with butter. I say it all the time when we're eating.
Ashley is in her late 20s. I caught up with her at a cafe in Washington's Union Station. She and her partner, Simon Underfirana, who's French, were waiting to board a train to New York. And they're eating a buttery snack with their afternoon coffee.
I am just breaking off a nice, hearty piece of this croissant.
Actually, it's pretty good for an American croissant.
It's flaky. It just creates this wonderful dough in your mouth while you're chewing it. It's delicious.
Now, Ashley's butter habit represents a paradigm shift in the U.S. that's been taking place gradually.
Americans are eating more butter. There's no question about it.
That's Harry Balzer, an analyst for the marketing research firm NPD Group, that tracks Americans' eating habits. He says back in the early 1990s, only about 30% of households he surveyed were cooking with butter or spreading it on their morning toast. What most families were eating was margarine.
Imperial. Only our taste deserves the crown.
Taste parquet margarine. The flavor says
butter.
But jump ahead to today, and many American families are no longer using margarine.
The increase in butter consumption in America coincides with the decline in margarine consumption. As a matter of fact, the increase in butter is really a story about the decrease in margarine.
So what explains this change? Well, for years, Americans had been getting the message to avoid animal fats, to protect our hearts. Cholesterol was the nutritional boogeyman, and margarine is cholesterol-free.
So back in 1992, 44% of all Americans were concerned about the amount of cholesterol that was in our food. Today, that number is 27%. It's dropped quite a bit.
And this is likely because the science of fat has really evolved. There was the revelation that trans fats, found in lots of margarines, were really bad for us, as well as the new evidence that eating some animal fat is not so bad. There's also a growing movement towards clean, less processed foods. That's another reason croissant lover Ashley Armstrong likes butter.
I just want the good stuff. I'm not going to have the fake stuff. Butter is more for me.
Now, you might assume that the rebound of butter would explain some of the news stories that have hinted at a possible butter shortage. But turns out, no, we're not eating that much more. What's really gobbling up supplies of American-made butter is the appetite of butter lovers in other countries, including Egypt and Morocco. Turns out, exports are way up. Here's dairy economist Brian Gould of the University of Wisconsin.
Since the early 2000s, we've basically gone from zero exports of butter to where it's 10 or 11% of our market. That's an incredible growth rate.
Now, as for the stories making the rounds on the internet about putting butter into your tea or coffee, well, Ashley's boyfriend, Simon, had this to say about it.
In France, we put butter on bread and then we dip it in the coffee.
So maybe that was the genesis of the whole buttering coffee.
Maybe, but we never just pour a spoon of butter in the coffee. Never.
So here's to good bread with your butter and coffee. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
He likes bread and butter. He likes toast and jam. That's what bathing feeds him. He's a loving man.
Well, I like bread and butter. I like toast and jam. That's what bathing feeds me. I'm a loving man.
Christianity, chicken sandwiches, and good customer service. That was the winning combination for S. Truett Cathy, the founder of Chick-fil-A. He grew up in poverty, and he became a billionaire. He died this morning at the age of 93. From member station WABE, John Lawrence reports.
S. Truett Cathy grew up during the Depression. At 8 years old, he set up a stand in his front yard and started selling 6 bottles of Coke for a quarter. Decades later, he and his brother opened a diner. And that diner became the building block of a fast food chain that now counts more than 1,800 restaurants in 40 states. Cathy attributed his material success to a mix of customer service, hard work, and Christian values. Values which drove him to keep all Chick-fil-A restaurants closed on Sunday. It was a company policy that he steadfastly defended and justified.
It has proven to my interests financially as well as convenience of permitting our people to have Sunday off where they can forget the business and other interests, devote it to the family as well as to worship if they so choose.
Victoria Smith has waited tables for 20 years at that original diner in Hapeville, Georgia.
He was like a grandfather. I've been known him all my life. I seen him every Sunday at church. He used to teach Sunday school. He taught the fifth graders at Jonesboro First Baptist.
Cathy's religious beliefs inspired loyalty among many customers, including Britt Kugler, who keeps coming back each week.
He really believed that it was a Sabbath and you shouldn't work on the Sabbath, and he lived it. He didn't just talk it, he lived it, because he could have made billions of dollars more by opening on through the years by opening on Sunday, and he chose not to do that.
Cathy's son, Dan, is now chairman and president of the chain. A few years ago, he criticized gay marriage and defended what he described as the biblical definition of a family. The comments drew protests from gay rights groups and many politicians, but the controversy didn't prevent the company from continuing to grow. Many customers chose to focus instead on the fried chicken sandwiches, the waffle fries, and the sweet tea. Last year, Chick-fil-A earned $5 billion and overtook KFC as the biggest-selling fast-food chicken chain in the country, drawn in perhaps by the company's well-known ad campaign featuring cows on billboards and commercials urging customers to
eat more chicken.
Cathy and Chick-fil-A made a name for themselves by stressing customer service. After each transaction, employees are taught to always say two words, "My pleasure." For NPR News, I'm John Lawrence in Atlanta.
Even though Michigan is surrounded by more than 20% of the world's fresh water, fish farming is largely unheard of there. This summer, though, the aquaculture industry there took a step forward, and that has touched off a debate over the appropriateness of fish farming on the Great Lakes. Peter Payette of Interlochen Public Radio has the story.
There's only one company in Michigan that raises fish for restaurants and grocery stores in large volumes. It's a family business on a few acres near Harrietta, Michigan, population 143. There's more than 500,000 fish here of various sizes, mostly rainbow trout. The largest ones weigh 1.5 pounds. Dan Vogler feeds them by hand, spraying pellets across the water, causing the surface to explode. Vogler wants to see more aquaculture in Michigan. He says with billions of people looking for fresh food, the state has an opportunity.
Not only an opportunity, but we have a responsibility to use our natural resources, use them responsibly to grow food.
Vogler's farm is on a creek that feeds the Manistee River on its way to Lake Michigan. This summer, his company received a state permit to develop a second operation, also inland, on the Asabo River. That's a popular trout fishing destination, and conservation groups are now challenging that permit, saying the state's not doing enough to protect the river. Dan Vogler says his operation causes no harm, and if Michigan wants to produce seafood, this is the right way to do it.
The reality is that the native Great Lakes wild fishery is in a state of general collapse. So if we're going to have locally available fish, it has to come from fish farms.
Even though Michigan borders every Great Lake but Ontario, there are few commercial fishermen left here. Half a century ago, the state decided that the lake should be used for recreational fishing, and state officials stocked them with Pacific salmon. In the decades that followed, sport fishing became big business here, all up and down the coast. That's why Howard Tanner was upset by a federal report this year suggesting that Michigan allow fish farms to operate on the Great Lakes. It was Tanner who ran the state's fish program in the 1960s when those first salmon were stocked in Lakes Michigan and Superior. He calls fish farming dangerous and maintains there is just no room for large fish pens in these lakes.
The net pen culture would be in the places most favorable to other recreational and leisure time activities. They want deep water close to shore. It doesn't mix with the sport fishery that is there.
One of the problems is fish waste adds nutrients, like phosphorus, to the water. Biologists say too much of it can harm the ecosystem and increase the kind of algae that contaminated Toledo's water supply this summer. Howard Tanner says fish farms that are in the ocean can deal with that waste, but not in a lake.
They have a flush for their system. It's called a tide. It flushes their waste products away into salt water. They're talking about no tides, and there's no possible way for them to treat their waste.
There are some commercial fish pens on the Canadian side of Lake Huron, raising mainly rainbow trout. And operators there say the concerns over nutrient loading are exaggerated, and that it might even help wild fish populations. Mike Rennie is a research biologist in Winnipeg and says an experiment done in a small lake in Canada did produce a benefit from fish farming.
Overall, the lake trout population in the lake seemed to actually do better during the course of the experiment. So the population estimates actually went up. Growth rates for the fish went up.
There are no proposals yet for fish farming in the Michigan waters of the Great Lakes. And judging by the controversy over expansion plans of just one inland operation, any proposal would likely face fierce opposition. For NPR News, I'm Peter Payette in Interlaken, Michigan.